there's a moment where you say, Dad, I love you. I want to be with the best part of you, not the worst part of you. You know, the part of you that taught me how to drive, not the part of you that, you know, that railed against hippies and this, that, and the other.
My name is Eliana. I'm a senior at Princeton, and you're listening to Here and There, a new podcast from the Princeton English Department. At this moment, when we're far away from each other, we'll come together in this podcast to share original work, have conversations about literature, and more. For this episode, I, along with Isabel, another senior in the English department, interviewed Professor Jeff Nunakawa about his work writing a new memoir, focusing on his family and beyond. Backing up a little bit, can you talk about when you started writing this? What made you decide to start writing this book?
So, in a sense, it goes back to, there are lots of things. It's kind of a certain personality, combinations of personalities and writing ambitions and all that met a certain modality, namely the social media. So I remember a comment that was made to me at when I published the book, the book about my notebook book. Somebody said to me at this party, he said, Facebook loves mothers. They love mothers. In other words, it's a place to go because it's a sort of universally. So I think in a way, what happened with this book was as I was writing those notes, which I did quite obsessively for many years, probably close to 10 years, I would write every day on Facebook. And those are little mini essays. I worked very hard on those things, those little essays. But I found myself increasingly aiming to reach, I don't want to say it, the word general audience is, I know, very mystified and problematic and all that, but an audience of way above and beyond, or I should say above and beyond, different from the audience that I had tried to reach with my academic work. And it meant a lot of retooling. So somehow the object of the writing, which was, I mean, and people loved my stories about my mom. You know, she's an original, which is to say she's a typical, right? She's that combination. She's that person. She's one of those people who you meet her and she's this, her very specificity is her generality, if you know what I mean. It's like the recipes, I mean, she's a big recipe believer, right? All that. Anyway, that sense that somehow I had something to say. You know, it's the way we all feel with our own writing, I think. I had this text or this collection of texts in me, namely what the way I was raised, and that I could phrase it in ways that would be, that would reach, not if not her, yeah, definitely her, but people like her. All those, you know, those people who turned to Facebook after the kids left it, right? All those people who go there now, the grandparents, but not just the grandparents, but just the sense I had that I could somehow, you know, that I could actually pitch my voice in a way that would reach people beyond or outside of the academic world. And it had to do with, you know, changing my writing a bit. Anyway, so that's the book came about. It came about partly as a consequence of all that stuff with the social media and a certain sense that, you know, as friends of mine who are my age, so your parents' age, I presume, or a bit older than your parents even, which was the sense that the world that we were raised in, that world of, you know, sort of mid-century, entirely problematic, but still quite coherent, except for the contradictions within it, race and all that, and the primary contradiction between capital, as we know it, the way that the economy works, and democracy, right? Because my parents were big Democrats, but that sense of that world of like you know you have things in common with people. People are That, as I say, that kind of semi melting pot sense that what matters is what we have in common. All that sense, and not what distinguishes us. All that, that kind of, you know, highly at this point problematic, I know, civil religion, right? That is, we're losing it. We're losing even what it meant. So I think that sense of trying to recover, and what I get a lot of from friends and readers elsewhere is the sense of like, yeah, that world is slipping through our fingers. At the very least, it would be important to kind of remember, not so much to defend it per se, although I'm not gonna lie, I do defend elements of it, not others, but to just remember it, because it is vanishing. That it is vanishing. It is vanishing with that generation. My next door neighbor here is an art historian, and we were talking one day a few months ago, And I said, I like her a lot. We're neighbors, but New York, Ellie. I'm just like, we talk, but we're not, you know, intimate. And I said, you know, Carol, I was just thinking, what would my dad be thinking about this? And she said, I think about that all the time. So that sense of that generation that has, you know, it's a political ethos, which is ironically, given what is all about being transcending individuals, which seems to be now, as it were, being lost with the loss of that generation. And it's, I think, so that's the sense of, a little bit the sense of the urgency. Well, urgency is the wrong word. I mean, it's not like this book is going to be that important, but it's what urges me on to do it. I want to, my mom will not be here long. I put it that way, not to be morbid, but she's 90. For all I know, she'll live 110. But just that voice, you know what I mean? The voice of that person for whom there was no president other than Franklin Roosevelt, those people are still alive. And it's good to hear them, you know, to remember how they sounded even when we were young, blah, blah, blah. So that's what I think. Yeah.
It seems like one of the ways that you try to sort of understand politics and the politics of each generation is by writing about these intimate familial spaces, which is interesting to me.
I think it's so important, you know, it's funny. I was talking to a kid a few weeks ago, and he reminded me of something I said, which was years ago, a student I had. He said, he's graduated, but he said that what I said to him was, you know, you can have all the intricate arguments you want. At the end of the day, what's going to get to me is the affect, the affective piece of it. Now, I didn't mean that as a way, and I was glad that he reminded me of this because I wanted to correct something that I'd said. I don't mean that I don't care a lot about the arguments. You know, the ones that are, you know, that are, as it were, Isabel, independent of those spaces, those intimate spaces. It's not that I don't care about those arguments, but what I care most about are the ways that those arguments and those intimate spaces inform one another, define one another, give one another life. Both, if that makes sense. You know, I mean, I probably told you this story. One of the foundations of this book was this moment with my dad in 1970. Have I told you the story about George McGovern? Do you know who George McGovern is? So George McGovern was the candidate for the Democratic Party, the Democratic Party's candidate in 1972. And he lost every state in the Union aside from, not even his home state, aside from Massachusetts. That's why after-
Oh yeah, he ran against Nixon.
Exactly. There were the bumper stickers.
You had the bumper sticker. Don't blame me. I'm from Massachusetts.
Exactly. With your parents or whoever, you know, who are. Yeah, exactly. And my father, being a sort of standard, I'm going to use this phrase in a way that I think you people will understand, a basic Democrat, right? He was a basic Democrat. He believed in reform and in change, but he also believed in being realistic and in the lesser of two evils. My parents were Gene McCarthy, Bobby Kennedy Democrats who were all in with Hubert in 68. So who was, you know, but my father thought it was a disaster and all that, but I was a little kid. I wasn't that little. I was 1972. I was 14. Yeah, right, 14. I was all in. I really believed in this, and I volunteered. I was all in. My dad saw this, and he didn't want to discourage me. He liked that I cared about this. So what he kept saying to me was, I was looking at these polls, and they didn't have the kind of polls in 72 that we have now. It wasn't instant polls. It was like, they'd come out some, but you saw what was happening. And I said, Dad, this doesn't look good. He said, never mind all that. He said, Jeff, there's a very simple mathematical principle here that I want you to remember. There are more have-nots in this country than there are haves. We're going to win in a landslide. Did my dad believe that? I don't know. Did he persuade himself to believe that long enough to make himself persuadable to his oldest son, who was enthusiastic about politics but easily terrified, largely by him? Do you know what I mean? That's one of those intimate spaces. You know what I mean? It's like, and I never, as I say in the book, I never heard my father concede after that he was wrong. My father never conceded anything, ever. And that was a horrible thing about him. But at moments, that kind of pig-headed samurai, suburban samurai, had its advantages. It's like, you know, basically, you know, F you, world, if you, this is the way it should be. Do you know what I mean? And so what could be an awful, an atrocious tyrant at home could also be someone that you'd want on your side in a political struggle. You know, like some of the students my father knew, even the ones he disagreed with, by God, he was going to defend forever their right to say whatever bullshit they wanted, because not just because they believed in free speech, but because he loved them. Not just because he believed in free speech, but because at the end of the day, he loved them. Even when they drove him crazy, maybe especially then, you know, maybe especially then. So that's kind of a way of talking about the inter-implication, as they say in the biz, but, between the affective, the intimate, and the political. Because I know my story is not atypical. Lots of people grew up this way. I know they did, you know. Maybe I'm just more of an exhibitionist about it than a lot of, but you know what I mean. Anyway, so that's me. You know, yeah, yeah.
Jeff, do you feel like there is any sort of moral dilemma ever in sort of writing about what you say? It can be very personal matters that your family would not necessarily have always wanted to be publicized, and sort of how you respect privacy while also telling your story, because it's also your story.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and the right question. It's the right question for any memoir, obviously. The way that it helps shape or inform the book I'm writing in particular is I want to take seriously, and in fact I do take seriously, the enjoyment to discretion and to privacy of a certain sort that my mother embodies. It's like, as long as you don't say too much. And what is too much? You know, I make a joke of this in the beginning of the book. Well, too much, I guess, is a little bit like what was it Potter Stewart, how he defined obscenity. I know it when I see it. So I kind of like that one of the ways that I best honor my mom and dad, I couldn't have written a word if my dad were alive. I really couldn't have, you know. But the way I best honor them is by observing, and I can always tell with my mom, and, you know, I'm very lucky she's still around, and when she, I have this in my heart now. It's like, I know what she would be okay with my saying, with my not being okay. And if I ever have any questions, I can ask her. You know, I know her rules. And when the book is done, you know, I hope while she's here, it will not be a book that will embarrass her. Do you know what I mean? Whether or not she's here. Do you know what I mean? So that's the way, I think, in some ways, observing some of those rules, and but making clear that this comes from a, you know, that what's the story is about. There's nothing, there's no way that I can, you know. So that's the one, that's the response to that necessary and necessarily central question about any writing about one's own, right? One's own family, however it's defined. Yeah, yeah.
Do you think that the act of writing the story has changed your perception of your identity, of your relationship to your family?
Yeah, truly, truly. It's made me easier to live with myself. Like, I feel like there's a person who's writing now, and that person is someone who is learning to live with a certain kind of clarity and a certain kind of combination of clarity and forgiveness, live with the life that I was brought up in. Like, when I say clarity, I mean, like, I'm not here to, I'm not trying to, you know, sort of paper over or idealize what the world I was brought up in, but I'm also not here to attack it. So that sense of the person who's coming out writing that. And, you know, there's some terribly dark things about my life, as there are for everybody's life, you know? I mean, and in fact, this current moment has helped me think about that, right? The invitations that we have all the time now to meditate on our more or less white privilege, right, has been a very important thing for me to think about. Interestingly, my father was way ahead of me in this game. But the sense of the way in which my own political position is inflected, defined by whatever kind of trauma I had about, you know, my father's strange views of race and my mother's race blindness. Interesting. One of the huge arguments they used to have was about being pulled over by the police for traffic violations. Because my mom she was great. She was, you know, she was like, it was like being with a, you know, like a, something in a gangster movie. I remember I was in a car with her once, and she got pulled over in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and she gets out of the car. She's got her cigarette in her mouth. She slams the car door shut, and she says to the cops, she would always call them cops, "What seems to be the problem, officer?" Now, my father in the 60s was always pointing out to her, more or less in rage, that was the privilege of her race. And he said it with a rage that was partly sort of what's the word I'm looking for? There was moral, there was whose ambivalence was partly undergirded by his envy. He wished that he could be like that. He wished that he didn't feel, in his own phrase to me, like a coward in the presence of police. So things like that were hugely, what's that word? Generative. They helped define who I am. But I want to talk about those things in a voice very different from the voice that you're hearing now. That is to say, most this thing, which is, me overexcited and all that. I want it to be much, not exactly chill, not exactly bland, but the person that I can become, I think, when I write, is the person I like. I like being around that person. I like that person. Would have been like, I like that person being around. He, she, they. They're much. Those persons. That person. Is just a lot more, not exactly chill, but sustainable over the long term. So I'm writing. I feel like I'm writing a self. This is the most optimistic thing I can say. I'm writing a self who will be a sustainable citizen moving forward, and a sustaining one. Yeah.
Quick activity. I'm just going to ask you a bunch of questions about your thoughts on books, and just give me your intuitive answer to.
I love it. Free association almost. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the last book that you read?
The last book I read were the letters of the Jane Welsh and Thomas Carlyle, the Carlyle letters.
If you could date a literary character, who would it be?
Oh, a literary, you mean from literature? Okay, it's coming to me. I can actually date him. I shouldn't say him. It's coming to me. Oh, this is a terrible confession to make to you. Date, not live with forever, right? One of the most evil characters in all of English literature, Grandcourt in Daniel Durando. Yeah.
What
you know him, Isabel? Yeah.
Anyway. What was your favorite book as a child?
Oh, that's easy. My favorite book as a child. I know. This is going to sound weird and it's going to sound slightly pretentious, but I was pretentious. Franny and Zoe. Yeah, as a kid. Yeah.
If you could bring one book to a desert island, which book would you bring?
The Bible. Yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Fair enough. What's a book that you've been meaning to read?
Right. A book that I've been meaning to read. Oh, so many. Oh my gosh. I can just look at my bookshelf here. I've been meaning to read. This is going to sound ridiculous, but I've been meaning to read Hegel's theories, a sort of lectures on religion.
Great.
I never will, but I've been meaning to. I still mean to. Yeah.
Great answers.
Yeah. Listen, you two, thank you so much for, I'm happy to go on, but I gather we're done, but thank you so much. I love you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This podcast was created by Eliana Cohen-Orth and Isabel Griffith-Gorgati. The music for this podcast was composed by Ed Horan. Jeff Nunakawa is a professor specializing in English literature from 1830 to 1900. He is the author of several books, the most recent of which is entitled Notebook, which features 250 brief essays initially posted on Facebook. Thank you for listening to this episode of Here and There. See you next time.